Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Would be 329.
Yeah, let me change. I thought I had changed that. I don't know. It says 328.
The answer is no one changed it.
Yeah, but see, my memory tells me I did. I think you went in the middle of the night and changed it. That's what I think.
That's totally what happened. Totally. And I'm leaving this part into the show, by the way. All right. Recording live from FYP Studios East and only one West this time, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 329 of Registry Matters. Larry, what's up, man? How are you?
Doing awesome. Now, remember, you were supposed to just to say 329, not 329.
No, you know, what it was, what happened was, is that I went 329, and there was this big, giant, gaping hole that you could drive a truck through, and that's why it separated it out into multiple words. But you just say 329, 329, I think it gets it. And we will find out, won't we?
We will indeed.
Let's do this real quick, and please make sure you like, subscribe, and press notify, and thumbs up, and podcast app, you know, all those things. And it will make me a happy camper. So, I think that's all I need to tell you to do, and now you're going to tell us what we're doing.
Well, first bad news, it's Mr. Gloom and Doom. Can you hear the agony and the sorrow?
There's so much sorrow.
Chance is unable to be with us tonight for this episode. But we do have a special guest that will be coming along shortly. They'll be discussing legislative proposals that are pending in Washington State. And we'll be looking at a PFR removal bill that's pending in North Dakota. And we're taking a look, a sort of a deep dive in a case from the Florida Court of Appeal that is at least temporarily a win for PFRs. That's what we're doing.
Whoa, this is almost like a good news show.
I'm sure Mr. Doom and Gloom can water it down.
I am confident that you will rear your ugly head, so to speak. Okay, well, here we go. So let me get down to this part down here. Let's start with this bill from North Dakota. Is North Dakota even a state? Where is North Dakota?
It is indeed a state, and I think there's about 600,000 or 700,000 people living there.
Six or seven people living there?
100,000.
All right, well, welcome to all the PFRs in North Dakota that listen to the program. This is House Bill 1231, and I've read this bill, Larry. I looked through it a dozen or so times, and as far as I can make heads or tails of it, it's about PFR registration relief. I'll say that again. It's about relief. Would you mind giving us a brief overview?
Well, I would mind, but I'll do it. The bill proposes creating a new section, would be identified as 12.1-32-15.1. That'll be contained within the North Dakota Century Code. I have no idea why they refer to their statutory scheme as the Century Code, but
I was going to ask you that question.
I double-checked it because I thought that AI had goofed up, and I said, nope, AI got it exactly right. So can you admit that that's funny?
That's super interesting. Why would they call it Century Code? I don't know.
Its main goal was to give low-risk PFRs who've completed at least 7 years of registration the opportunity to petition a court to end their registration requirement. But essentially, they have to prove that they've maintained a clean record and demonstrate that continued registration isn't necessary for public safety and protection.
Where is the bill now? What's its current status?
Well, it's actually moving along nicely. It received a do-pass recommendation from the House Judiciary Committee and ultimately passed the full House on June 24th, 62-29, which is a substantial amount of support.
Yeah, that is totally.
Now in the Senate. Now, the 29, I didn't have enough time to do a deep analysis and see who the 29 were that voted against it, but it's still, that's a lopsided majority, 62-29.
And just in your like political experience, if something is that lopsided, it is, would it fail in the next chamber? It seems like if it were that strong, it's not likely to fail.
Well, that is very logical, but that is not the way it really works in life. It could very well fail in the next chamber, but it does give it momentum going into the Senate, because they do notice the tally sheet, everything comes over from the House, so they'll get that information. But they're an independent chamber, and they will do their own analysis, and there will be potential for the bill to be killed if enough support and opposition can be rallied. But yes, it does give it momentum going in with that kind of margin.
And it's pretty exciting that it's moving forward. How exactly does someone qualify to petition for relief under this new bill? Do they have to send smoke signals? Do they just like a minimal amount of paperwork? Do they have to hire the highest paid attorneys? Whatever. What do they have to do?
Well, the bill states that an offender must be categorized as low risk by the Attorney General. And that means that they already have a risk-based system in place, because otherwise that would make no sense. But then after 7 years of registration, they can file a petition with either the sentencing court or the district court where they live. And I really like that, because you may have been sentenced in a place that's not going to be very hospitable. And if you've moved to a place that's more forward-thinking, if that's the way it actually is going to work in real practice, I like that. But the low-risk assessment and the 7-year time frame are crucial eligibility requirements. You've heard me talk about in the past about if you don't meet the statutory requirements, why do you file? If you've only been registering for 3 years and you're not rated low risk, black letter law, if this becomes law, you don't qualify. If you got an attorney that says, I'll take your money and I'll file a petition anyway, then you need to run as fast as you can possibly run away from that attorney.
Just to compare it to the way that I understand a state like Georgia, if you are convicted in that state, not if you're, you know, if you're a transplant, but if that is your state where you were convicted, you are going to petition the court where you were sentenced, whether you've moved from Atlanta down to Savannah or whatever, you have to go back to the court of your conviction.
And that's what I like about this, because it gives you the opportunity to do some forum shopping.
Right.
If you're sophisticated and you do a little research before you file that petition, and you find out that in the county and the court where you've filed, not a soul's been released, and they've had 23 of these by the time you get around to filing yours. And then you go to the county where you think it might be better, and you find out that 60% of the petitions have been granted. You'd have to be a complete idiot to file in the petition where you were convicted.
Sure. Complete idiot. Gotcha. And what does the court process look like? How does the victim's role factor into this? Do they end up having a second, third, fifth bite of the apple then?
Great question. And unfortunately, they do have a second bite of the apple.
Of course they do.
According to the current language, first, the offender serves the petition on the state's attorney in the county where the petition is filed. The state's attorney then notifies the victim of the offense if the victim's address is known or can be reasonably found. Now, I like that reasonably found, because I don't know what that means. That's not defined. The court will hold a hearing where it considers the victim's statements that can be either in writing or spoken. After reviewing the facts and hearing from everyone involved, the court decides whether the offender has a clean record and whether continued registration is necessary for public safety.
And tell me, dig into this clean record thing. The bill specifically defines what that means, right?
It does. In that particular instance, it does. It means that during the entire registration period, the offender hasn't been convicted of a felony or any sexual offense. Now, I can't imagine there's any sexual offense in North Dakota that's not a felony. But anyway, you can't be convicted of any sexual offense or any felony. They also must have successfully completed any supervised release, probation, or parole without any revocation. And finally, they must have finished all court-ordered treatment programs. So the standard for a clean record is fairly concise, as far as I can tell.
It also sounds fairly standard. Those, you know, doing the treatment, no violations of any kind, and so forth. I mean, those sound fairly standard.
They do.
And if the court believes the individual is no longer a threat to public safety, they can grant the petition to end registration? Like, just like that, snap their fingers and you're done?
correct. The judge has the discretion. It says may grant the petition. And the judge has discretion to grant relief from registration if the judge finds that registration isn't necessary to protect the public, and that if it serves the broader interest of society to allow the offender to reintegrate more fully. And I'm going to be interested to see how they balance those two, because the state and the victims will be arguing that it's needed for public safety. And if I'm on the other side, I'm going to be arguing that it allows my client to be a full productive taxpayer member of the community and to move on with their life. And it's going to be interesting to see how they balance those two.
I also noticed that there's a provision about possibly closing the hearing. Why might that be included?
Well, I'm guessing closing the hearing is a measure to protect both the offender's privacy, especially in sensitive matters related to sexual offenses, and in some cases, the victim's safety. However, even if the court hearing is closed, the victim has the right to be present unless the court finds their presence would conflict with privacy rights or personal safety concerns. A support person can also attend on the victim's behalf. But it appears, as I was looking at that, there's some language stricken, and it appears that that provision you referenced may have already been struck from the bill.
I see. Well, let's move over to talk about some implications. How do you see this bill impacting various stakeholders, like the offenders, the victim, and as well as the public, to go with it?
Well, for low-risk offenders who have shown that they can live a law-abiding life for 7 years, it provides a path to end registration, which can be a significant stigma. For victims, it might raise concerns about whether it's too soon or if the individual poses a potential risk, hence the opportunity for victims to voice any objections they have. And for the public, the idea to balance the safety benefits of the registry with the possibility that someone who's truly rehabilitated shouldn't bear the burden indefinitely. On the government side, courts and prosecutors will have to handle these petitions, so there's an administrative workload component, but presumably the number of low-risk offenders won't overwhelm the system. Now, that's my hope and presumption, because courts generally fight back at things that are going to dramatically increase their workload, because think about this. You have a limited amount of days in a court calendar month. Would you agree with that?
I believe so.
All right. Then you have a limited amount of support personnel, and all these things are going to require multiple moving parts to adjudicate these petitions. So if it looks like this is going to be overwhelming, there will be representatives from the administrative side of the courts saying, hey, we can't handle this, but let's hope that it's not going to be an overwhelming amount of work, because we could get pushback from the judiciary saying we don't want this.
I can't do this kind of math in my head while we're recording a podcast. I don't know that I could do this anyway. But there, since you said there are 600,000 people, someone told me that there's 2,100 people in total on the registry in North Dakota. I don't see how the court would be overwhelmed by this.
Well, if you had 2,100 courts, but say you have in the whole state of North Dakota, say you have 23 district judges, or okay, 23 whatever trial level judges, and you're going to have 20 of these a year, I mean, you're talking about a potential for some significant additional workload. So that's where the potential for objections come.
But I don't know what the ratio is between low, medium, and high risk people, but you at least you don't have all 2,100 people eligible by their risk assessment or time.
Correct. So let's hope that the analysis is correct, that it won't be overwhelming and the judiciary will not object.
So somebody else, there are 53 district courts in North Dakota. So I can see that there might be some controversy that might arise from all this. 7 years might feel too short for some, but too long for others. And are there other potential controversies?
Sure. One debate might be about how low risk level is determined.
Yeah.
Another is where the judges will interpret the standard of public protection strictly or leniently. Some might say that any risk should prevent relief, and others would argue that the person's track record should be the guiding factor. Also, the idea of closing hearings might concern open government advocates who believe the public transparency is key. And I could guarantee you here, if this were proposed in my state, the Foundation for Open Government, FOG as it's known, they would be all over this, saying, no, you cannot close the court. That's what they would be saying.
Interesting. And is there a retroactive element if there's someone who has already, like, if you've already level one or whatever it is, and then you've already got your 7 years or more, can you just, like, sign up right when the bill becomes law?
You can. This bill's application section clarifies that if someone has already met the 7 year requirement before the bill takes effect, they can petition as soon as it's enacted and signed. Otherwise, they can petition once they hit the 7 year mark after the effective date.
That's awesome. And that's a pretty thorough breakdown, though, I think. That's all that we have for 1231. Any last words or advice? Do you think that this would apply to someone moving there from out of state? Or is this only for in-state people?
It wasn't addressed anywhere in the language that I could see. But I would certainly argue that people there would have the Equal Protection Clause to cite to and say that they should be able to petition off. So I don't know why they would be excluded.
So we've got a guy in Colorado who's been on the registry for like coming up on 30 years. And if he could get there and be listed as a tier one, level one, whichever one it is, then he could effectively be off the registry upon arriving in the state, basically?
Well, not so fast here. We got to take into account, does he have to be registered 7 years in North Dakota?
Well, that's kind of what I was asking. Okay.
So, yes, I don't know the answer to that, but we just had a recent decision where it was made clear that if the legislature had wanted it to include time registered in other states, they would have done that.
I see. All right. Well, as usual, you put a doom and gloom spin on it. But thank you. Well,
it wasn't that doom and gloomy, was it?
No, it definitely wasn't. Well, I am going to press play on this button of this interview, and you can go use the potty or something like that.
Okay.
All right. Here's an interview I recorded earlier today. All right. Well, joining us now is Kathleen Hambrick, and she's a dedicated mother and one of the founding members of CAGE, which is cage.info, where she has advocated for due process and justice reforms. She continues her work by writing Lady Justice Myth, and that's ladyjusticemyth.blog, sharing personal stories that highlight the complexities of the legal system. And Kathleen has also appeared on the Dr. Phil Show, which we should actually talk about at some time. And then... that was to further raise awareness about her cause. So you wanted to talk about a couple bills in Washington state?
Yes, there are two new bills that are have been entered into the Senate, and we're very excited, CAGES, about this, particularly because my son was arrested and prosecuted in the state of Washington for a proactive sting. So the two new bills are, the first one is 5282, which reestablishes an advisory board concerning the people, MECTIF, which is Missing and Exploited Children's Task Force, concerning an oversight on them. It reestablishes the advisory board. And the second is in the Senate. It adjusts the sentencing standards for proactive sting, parole, and registration.
Can you spell that acronym, MECTIF?
M-E-C-T-F.
M-E-C-T-F. Okay, just wanted to make sure. Because whatever MECTIF transcriptionists we have at this point in time need to make sure that they... MECTIF? Like, what did you just say? and why is the advisory board important?
So without the advisory board, police proactive stings, they don't follow their own rules. And they've found that since there are financial incentives to not following the rules. So without having an advisory board watching what the police are doing, what we found is that they're going on to adult sites. They're saying they're looking for certain people, but then the people they end up arresting have none of the goals of the missions that they're stating they're going after. So in fact, even in the case of my son, who finally got an acquittal, the police officer on the stand admitted that none of the things that were in the mission statement applied to Jace's case. So, you know, an advisory board would see that their goals and their true goals and their mission statements were aligned, which is not happening right now.
It almost sounds like it's an oversight versus advisory.
Yes, that's what we want it for, is oversight, but it's called advisory in the statutes.
And how will the advisory board differ, since you said that they're reintroducing or reestablishing whatever? How is it different this time around?
Right. So this time around, there's actually going to be lawyers on the board. There was always the MECDIF falls under Washington State Police. There was always the chief of the police department that was on the board, and then other police chiefs or sheriffs from around the state. But this time there's going to be a prosecutor, prosecuting attorney, and very importantly, a defense lawyer attorney on the board, and additionally a person appointed by the AG. So not all the police can't, you know, however they say that, circle the wagons and try to cover up if something's wrong. A defense attorney would know what was going on and whether or not it was on the up and up. And that's very important to have somebody watching over their shoulder.
I would think so. And then why was the advisory board, why was the other one disbanded in the first place? For them to like reintroduce it, why would you get rid of the first one?
Right. So the reason why proactive stings got so bad in the state of Washington was because of a certain lead detective. Back in 2014, there was a lead detective named Carlos Rodriguez, and he came up with a scheme in order to what basically ends up now entrapping citizens. It didn't start out that way. I'm going to give him my good faith and say that he had the best of intentions, but he connected up with a third-party private organization that got him into trying to, you know, go to adult websites, use adult pictures, and talk aggressively in order to get men to show up so that this third party's donations could be raised massively. And so he realized early on that he couldn't do that with an advisory board watching what he was doing.
Sure.
He was a pretty smart cookie, yeah. So he actually got it removed back in 2015. It was removed. And the advisory committee was, quote unquote, unnecessary. So he had carte blanche to do whatever he wanted to. And trust me, he did.
Huh. Now, I guess often is the case with some kind of advisory board that they're there in name only. Like, hey, you shouldn't do that, but they don't have any teeth. So do they have some kind of binding authority, or is it just strictly advisory?
You know, it says that they're just making best practices for the stings. But honestly, anybody watching over this, you know, when they see some of the tactics, they're going to have to object. And so where that will lead to, I'm not sure, but it's the first step, and we're happy to have it.
And will the board's meetings and decisions be made public?
So I guess in the state of Washington, there's something called OPMA, which is Open Public Meetings Act, which they're supposed to be, any government meetings are supposed to be, for transparency reasons, available to the public. So theoretically, they will be made public, yes.
I recently heard someone talking about something like this. I think it was in Colorado that they were talking about this, of the review board for the PFRs. And they're like, well, I got kicked out. I wasn't allowed entry into the meeting, whatever the circumstances were. And it was like, well, there's this open meeting policy in the state. Like, they can't do that. Okay, maybe you say they can't do that, but they did it. And
right.
They can do it until they're told to stop, as someone often references me to the expression.
Right. So we don't know if it's going to happen or not, but it's supposed to happen.
Gotcha. Well, then at least if you know that framework is there, you could be like, here, it says that this has to be open. You could show them the document. Anyway, is there a way for people who feel like they were wrongly targeted by a sting to file a complaint?
So apparently within 5282, there is something about review and evaluate complaints concerning stings. And so this would suggest that people could bring things there. You know, how it's going to pan out or to what degree they'll do that, because, you know, I'm not going to go into the funding or not, but that goes into funding, because in order to investigate things, you have to have people funded in order to investigate. So I'm not sure how that'll work, but we're hopeful that, you know, we'll be able to submit our concerns.
I'm intrigued by the concept that you could have, though, a defense attorney, or maybe even like a civil rights organization. Do you think that this really falls into the area where people's civil rights are violated?
Oh, 100%. Absolutely. Civil rights are violated here. Well, you already know that. So that was a facetious little question, I'm sure.
It was. It was something of like, here's a softball one for you.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
What does the second bill address?
Okay, so the second bill is even more aggressive. It literally calls out proactive stings, which are labeled quote unquote net nanny in the state of Washington. And it adjusts the parole and registration sentencing standards from what they are right now, which is lifetime for both, to something more in line with a police-initiated victimless attempted crime. So previously in Washington state, all attempted crimes were given parole and registration that matched a completed hands-on crime. So a proactive sting, you know, arrestee or conviction, would get the same parole and registration as someone who actually did, say, offend against a minor, which in Washington state is lifetime. So right, now right. the amendments were they to pass, persons without any sexual offense history would receive 3 years parole, which they call community custody in the state of Washington, and 5 years registration. Huge difference.
Big time. Just because I'm a conflicted person, if I remember right, in Georgia, attempted kidnapping. So the way that I'm imagining what attempted kidnapping would be is like you've actually like grabbed the person, put a bag over their head, and as you were throwing them into the trunk of the car, they somehow escaped. That, to me, in my mind, that is attempted kidnapping, and you probably should prosecute the person to that fullest extent because they really tried hard. They just failed at it. Right. This is a different kind of attempt to me.
Correct. And when this was first put into play, it was 1975. The internet didn't exist. So attempted meant exactly what you just said. Yeah. Now attempted could be, I talked to somebody, they said they were an adult, and then they said they were a child. And suddenly that's attempted abduction or rape.
Right. Yep. Do you think that these changes to the sentencing and registration apply to people already serving lifetime registration and parole things, or will this only to the people after this goes into effect, only to new cases?
Right. So 5312, which is the bill, it focuses on future convictions, but there is language that would suggest an avenue of retroactive relief. I mean, that might be the next step. Theoretically, some individuals that are already on lifetime parole and registration due to a sting might be able to petition to get off of it, but you know, we're just trying to move it along any way we can, honestly.
That is a significant difference for the people that are coming down the pike that are going to have these charges brought against them. It is a big difference.
It's huge. Yes. And I feel the second bill will be a hard one to pass because it is such a big difference. I think the first one with the Oversight Committee is a no-brainer. And I think anybody who, you know, stood up against that would be under criticism because, you know, across the whole country, we're all over trying to watch what the police are doing. But even if this one doesn't pass, it also serves the purpose of allowing the people that know what's going on to be able to bring awareness to the legislators and to reach different sections of the public. And we get to educate on what's been happening. And that's a powerful tool for all of our efforts over these years. So the bills themselves are really win-win scenarios for all of us.
Before we close out, do you happen to know anything about the sponsors? Are these different groups? Is it the same person putting out a bill of like least impact versus one that's more? Do you know anything about the people that have sponsored it?
So I can tell you that it was created off of the push of a Cage family, the husband and wife and their 20-year-old son, who was convicted in one of these and is currently serving a 9-year sentence for a victimless crime. Yeah, how sad is that? The Glantz, their name is The Glantz, and they pushed legislator for the last 7+ years and have finally gotten here. They have probably a dozen legislators on their side now, just by harping on over and over about what's wrong with these and bringing evidence and people's voices. And so they actually have quite a good collection of people sponsoring these bills. There's probably, I think, 6 on one and 5 on another. So they have some good power behind it. And so we're hopeful, certainly, that the one oversight will be passed and at least that this will make it to the floor and get a vote.
And I believe I've met this couple.
Yes, you have. Yes, you did.
Gotcha.
Exactly right.
So all that sounds amazing. Like, hey, wow, there's good news out there. How can the people, the vast audience that we have of millions of listeners, how can they help out?
Right. So both of these bills are slated for hearings on Monday. Now, I don't know how quickly, you know, anybody would be able to help, but we have links on my blog, ladyjusticemyth.blog. There are four links to go in and vote pro for these. So we want you to follow them. If you're in state or out of state, there's different rules.
Sure. And on that, though, so people outside of the state, this is not only a call to the three people in Washington that listen to the podcast, but so people outside can help as well.
Yes, exactly. So there's four links total on my website. They're the first thing that comes up. And anyone can use their real address and mark pro, like as in positive, not con, on the two links marked for out of state support for the to be counted as a vote for the bill. And we really need help on this. We were told by the legislators that if we didn't get 1,000 pro votes, that the chances of this going anywhere were really slim. So I'm begging everybody out there to go on there, use your own address, and go to the first two links on the website and mark it as pro. If somebody is listening or knows anybody that lives in Washington State, could you please do, in addition to those first two, the second two links, which are marked for only for Washington State people, because they require you to put in a valid Washington address, and it validates your address and then tells you who your representatives are. And then I hate when I misspeak. And then it only updates those representatives, not the entire organization. Senate. There we go.
Words are hard. I understand completely.
I know. Absolutely. But again, everyone can do this, and it is so important. We really need your help. Really do.
To me, feels like one of the easy areas, like the easy wins of people that would be sympathetic to super young individuals that get wrapped up in this mess. It's really just horrid. It really is. Anytime I hear these conversations, well, thank you for coming on. I appreciate you sharing all this with me.
Of course. And thank you for having me. It's so important. And I appreciate having this outlet to get out there to reach people.
Sadly, though, this won't go out to the masses until Tuesday. But I imagine that they could still go vote. It just won't be in time for the committee.
For the hearing. But it's still going on. So we need all the votes. Vote on Tuesday if you hear this. Thank you.
All right. Have a great afternoon, Kathleen. Thanks. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
You ready to move along?
I am indeed. That was a great episode. See, you really don't need me.
Need. You know, that's kind of something like that. Well, Larry, do you know that the number one way that you can support Registry Matters is by becoming a patron?
I would agree with that. And at a certain level of pandemic relief funds would be the correct level.
We have different levels of patron, all of which give you access to our live stream recordings. As a patron, you'll get ad-free versions of the show, which means there's no filler or bumpers in the middle of it that I throw in on most of those episodes. And after the show, you get to have a Q&A session, which means you can ask the most absurd questions to Larry about economics, about accounting, about policy, about if you can shoplift from your grocery store. But your support always helps. It helps us keep the show going. And so forth, and helps us deliver this deep, in-depth legal analysis that you count on. So, Larry, what should people do?
Well, obviously, they should become patrons if they can. There's a lot of other things that you outlined, but they should become a patron if you can.
That's right. And there are a few other ways that you can help. You can join our mailing list, which I am working on. I was working on it today, and it just didn't quite work its way out. And that way, I'm going to start sending out weekly updates or take a moment to rate the show. Ratings are incredibly helpful for bringing new listeners into our community, whether that's on Apple Podcasts or another platform, whichever one. Your rating makes a difference. Thank you for your support. Now, you wanted to talk about this decision from the Florida, with emphasis on D-U-H, and this is the 5th District Court of Appeals. It's regarding the controversy if governmentally compelled designations on the front of a Florida driver's license or ID cards for people convicted of certain offenses. Governmentally compelled markings on driver's license or IDs for individuals convicted of specific crimes.
That is definitely a topic that's been making waves and generating some discussion, and it's an important one. So let's do it.
I saw this all over the listserv, didn't I?
You did.
Okay. Now, may I give you a brief, give you a brief summary about what's happening?
You can.
All right. So according to a recent appellate excerpt, the debate centers on a law or policies that require the Florida Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles to place special markings or notations on the driver's license or ID cards of people convicted of certain offenses. The main question is whether forcing individuals to carry these labels violates any constitutional rights, especially the prohibition against compelled speech. Now, to me, Larry, that sounds like it could touch on both public safety concerns and individual rights. Would you be so kind to talk about the legal arguments on each side?
Sure, I will be happy to do the best I can. On one hand, supporters argue it enhances public safety. People in law enforcement can immediately identify someone with a serious criminal history, like a PFR type offense. On the other hand, opponents believe it's a form of compelled speech or branding that imposes significant stigma, which I come down that side. They worry it violates constitutional protections, such as the First Amendment's Free Speech Clause and the Fourth Amendment's Due Process and Equal Protection Clauses.
How did we end up at the appellate court level?
Well, an individual named Michael Crist, C-R-I-S-T, challenged the requirement after being compelled to carry a license with a marking indicative of his conviction. The appeals court is now determining whether the policy stands on solid legal ground, particularly regarding the First Amendment, while balancing it against the state's justification for public safety. But there's some humor that was left off here. The way he got caught was that he was getting a PFR safety home visit, and he was asked to produce his driver's license. And he had covered it with the marking with something, and he was scratching that off, and they did not think it was as funny as I think it is.
So would he put a little Sharpie or a piece of tape over it or something?
Yes. That's you can't. So you're admitting that one's funny.
That's not funny, Larry. The marking in general is just ridiculous. It is, well, the last time I talked about it, I think I was proven wrong, but it's pretty small. It's not like the freaking do not enter sign that they were doing in Oklahoma and Alabama. Those things are ridiculous. Well, before we get into this, the court stated the first step is determining the nature of a Florida driver's license. Is it a governmentally controlled form containing government speech, private speech, or is it a hybrid of the two? Now, why is that important?
It is important because it alters the level of judicial scrutiny. If it's purely government speech, it would only be the lowest level, which is referred to as a rational basis review. But if it's personal speech that's being compelled, then it elevates the level of judicial scrutiny to at least intermediate and likely a strict scrutiny. So it's very important to identify what type of speech this is.
Can you dumb that down for me? Of how could you give me some kind of real world example of what that sentence means?
Well, because the level of deference from an appellate level court is divided into those three prongs. Rational basis is the lowest level of scrutiny, the highest level of deference, meaning that if there's any rational reason that the lawmakers could come up with for doing it, it passes constitutional muster.
I mean, is this me putting on a t-shirt? That's my form of expression?
But we're talking about the level of judicial scrutiny here, right?
What would be, if it being personal, what document do you carry that is yours? I see where we're going with the hybrid thing, that it's your speech and government speech. I see where that's going. I can't see what personal speech would be in this context.
Well, government gets to speak freely. The Constitution protects people from being forced to speak.
Right.
Or prohibiting them from speaking. So, and for this court to move forward, it needed to determine who's speaking. If this is a government speech or if this is personal speech. And so that was why that was so important, because the level of judicial deference would depend on what type, who's speaking.
I see. Okay. I think I got you. Then, and what's Florida's position then?
Well, according to the court, the state candidly and justifiably conceded to the court, and it has not argued that the sexual predator designation on the Florida driver's license is purely government speech, which would be subject to little or no judicial scrutiny. Now, I'm surprised that they didn't try to maintain that it was strictly government speech, but they at least acknowledged that it was not just government speech.
And then, so what makes this personal speech?
Well, as the court explained, a Florida driver's license is a conglomeration of government and personal speech, some of it compelled by law to be on the license, such as sexual predator, and some of it voluntarily placed there by the person, like organ donor, veteran, deaf, and developmentally disabled. I've never seen that designation, but that's what it said. The back of the card has additional voluntary designations for holders, like the Florida Lifetime Wildlife Commission, freshwater fishing, hunting, saltwater fishing, and sportsman license. None of the things I've ever seen before. And symbols such as bass, deer, and sailfish, and on. So some of this is you're also speaking your home address. You probably would not want the public to know that, but you're speaking it. So it's a hybrid. It's government speech and it's personal speech.
Because I put veteran when I got my new driver's license, I put veteran on it. I figured that when you hand that to law enforcement, that they would be to some degree more lenient with you.
And that is a good thought process. But if you were compelled to do that and you didn't want to do maybe you had renounced your allegiance to the United States Armed Forces and you didn't want that, then that would be compelled speech.
I'm totally with you. Now, if we can dig deeper into this, I've not considered a driver's license to be anything more than proof of my authorization to drive a car. And I got pulled over. I was walking back from lunch. This is shortly after that I was released from my little vacation. And they were looking for someone. And like, to some degree, I fit the description, which means like tall white dude. So he's like, hey, can I see your driver's license? And I didn't have any reason to resist. And I'm sure deputy would be like, oh, you should have resisted all the way until they locked you up. And I'm like, I'm not trying to do all that. But anywho, I can see that it's just proof that I have passed the test that I'm allowed to drive and also identification. So what makes this personal speech?
Well, the court explained it really far better than I could. They stated, with its mixture of information, images, and symbols, a Florida driver's license cannot be seen simply as a plastic card containing only government speech. That's because several of the features are private or personal information that license holders want to convey to others. Plus, most of the governmentally required information, such as address, date of birth, height, sexual crimes, is not purely governmental. You probably, if you weigh 700 pounds, don't want everybody to know that unless they can figure it out by looking at you. It is factual information about the license holder that is personal only to him. Some people don't like facts about themselves to be known, such as their confidential home address. So that's why this is so different. It is a mixture of personal and government speech.
I understand. God, it's so weird. Civil regulatory scheme, right?
Of course.
What's the potential impact if the court rules one way or the other?
Well, if this decision is upheld, this is kind of backwards, but if this decision is upheld that the Court of Appeal made, Florida would actually have to change how they're doing their driver's license markings. If this decision is reversed that the Court of Appeal made, then Florida would continue to require these obligations. But that's the potential outcome of it, is that it's going to depend on this case is going to the Supreme Court of Florida, and we're going to have to wait and see what the Supreme Court does.
Are there any broader historical political contexts we should know about?
Well, this debate reflects longstanding tension between public safety policies, especially those surrounding those with felony PFR offense convictions, and individuals' rights. Over the past several decades, states have ramped up notification registration laws, and critics such as we are claim that these laws go too far, effectively punishing individuals beyond their sentences. There can be no doubt about this. If you're forced to be branded after you've served your complete sentence, this is punishment. But proponents see them as community safeguards.
I mean, the person I reference, that we chat, not quite every day, but damn close to it, that lives in the Tampa Bay area. He's he's been on the registry since like the early 90s, late 80s or something like that. And like, and why? He did his little bit of time and he's been free ever since. He lives in a magnificently beautiful house. He's raising some kids and they're doing fabulous. His wife is successful. Like, he is living a model citizen life, yet 4 times a year he has to go do his registration and he has the marking on his driver's license. It's like, he can't get out from underneath it, no matter what he does. He has tried. He's even talked to you on the phone not too long ago about what his shots are, I think.
Indeed.
So from a legislative standpoint, could the Florida legislature modify this policy to address some of the criticisms?
Oh, they absolutely could modify it. They could narrow the scope to only certain severe offenses. Lawmakers, I know you listen to us. You can do almost anything if you don't paint with such a broad brush. You can improve the due process for procedures to challenge or remove the designation. And you could add sunset provisions to revisit the individual's situation or the effectiveness of such markings. You could do a lot of things, but you just can't help yourself. But revising the law could reduce future legal challenges because there are organizations that are going to keep coming after you if you keep doing these things. And hopefully we grow in strength and we'll have more and more financial resources and we'll ramp up coming after you. So if you keep doing it, you'll keep encountering us.
Now, before we wrap up, what should our vast listening audience take away from this discussion?
Well, they should understand that legal policies about marking driver's licenses reflect bigger questions about balancing constitutional rights against public safety. It's certainly a nuanced issue that's ultimately for the courts and potentially the legislature to clarify. Our stakeholders across the political spectrum should continue to weigh in, and citizens should stay informed as the courts and lawmakers shape the future of these requirements. So to simplify that, if this is a decision that's affirmed by the Florida Supreme Court, the lawmakers in Tallahassee will have to revisit this. Make sure you're there, you know, that you have an organizational presence.
This doesn't have any impact on any of the surrounding states. When we said the circuit court or whatever it was, this only applies in Florida, right?
Correct. This is in the state's court system in Florida. It's going to the state Supreme Court.
And the court, the final piece of this, the court stated that the massive, ugly PFR designation that was on Chris's driver's license is impermissibly compelled speech under the prevailing judicial test, in no way involves the use of judicial power to compel a specific change to statutory law. It merely holds that the specific designation is off limits under the Bill of Rights enacted by and for the people. No judicially compelled change of this law is made. Whether the government chooses to use a particular number, symbol, color, or font size in place of the current designation is not something a court directs or involves itself in. The state might choose to use statute numbers, but use red for bad, bad, bad PFRs and blue for normal PFRs. It might use symbols that the public readily understands. It might choose to issue a separate freestanding PFR offender identification cards that PFRs and bad, bad PFRs must present when asked. These are decisions for the legislative and executive branches, not the judicial branch. This makes it clear that there will likely be some kind of marking in the future.
It does indeed. And the Court of Appeal has actually stayed the issuance of the mandate, which is, comes down with a decision typically. And this was done to provide the Florida Supreme Court an opportunity to weigh in as well. So we are waiting for what the Supreme Court will do. And I'd say within the next 6 months to a year, we'll know.
And your thoughts, like it, to use your crystal ball and see the future, Larry, what do you think will happen?
Well, there were dissenting opinions in this particular case. I don't know the Florida Supreme Court makeup well enough. I think that it's an elected bunch. I think that there's no guarantee that they're going to affirm the appellate decision. They could reverse this. It's a risky thing, but it's going to the state's highest court, and we will see what they do. But if they affirm, they've already given you the roadmap of what's coming. You're still going to have a marking. It just won't be as gross and blatant and unconstitutional as it is now, because I can't see Tallahassee saying, well, we're going to throw up our hands. We won't mark the license. They're not going to do that. They're going to continue to mark the license.
especially with Ron Book and Lauren Book in there.
Correct.
So, affirm means, and I'm just going to say this like this way, affirm means the markings go away. And to, what's the opposite of affirm?
They would overturn or reverse.
To overturn would mean that it stays the way it is.
Yes.
God, that's complicated. I really hate, there's this debate show I listen to, and they'll ask like a negative question. So are you in favor of the negative question? And I, like, could you have not just asked the question the other way so that you're answering yes to yes and not yes to, like, I hate when they do that. That's complicated. That makes my head hurt.
But it's simplified by one thing. This decision is being appealed. It's a favorable decision. So you want the favorable decision to be affirmed.
I'm with you. But it's the what they're trying to do is strike down the markings on the driver's license. So the action is negative, so they're upholding a negative. It's complicated, Larry. So. It is to me. Would you like to make your announcement about the transcript service?
I will, and I'll make it brief because we don't have all the details. The transcript service, as we know it, will be discontinued. We've been struggling for a long time trying to make it work. We do not have a sufficient subscriber base. We do not have a sufficient revenue base to support it. And we're hugely subsidizing it with money that we don't really have available to do that, which means that we can no longer afford to pay a transcriptionist, which means that if we have a transcript, it will be generated by artificial intelligence, or it may be a summary. Those details are in the works. Anybody who is unhappy with the changes that we make, we will give you a prorated refund very generously. We'll take into account all the issues that episodes that may have been missed and adjust the refund. We will tell more details. We'll provide more details of how to go about getting those refunds. We're not going to sign up with JPay and all these complicated things to send money to you, but we will send money to an outside connection. Or someone, if the prison system has an easy system where we can go download a form and send a money order, we will do that. But we're not going to cheat anybody out of their money. But whatever service we provide will not be referred to as a transcript. It'll be clearly identified as something generated by AI. And it may or may not accurately reflect what we've said.
Well, very well. It's unfortunate, but it's completely understandable. Not you did mention like the finances, and finances also applies, but time is another significant aspect of this.
Absolutely. It's a huge undertaking to put this together in the form of a written document and to clean it up. We start with an AI version, but it's a lot of work to correct it because AI is just not there yet in terms of accuracy. And we just don't have the budget. We would need $300 to $400 a month in additional revenue because that's about what it cost us to produce this product. And our revenue stream is nowhere near that of what we're getting off of income.
Well, with that said, on those fine, happy notes, Larry, do you have anything else that you'd like to say?
Looking forward to seeing everyone in the following episode.
Fantastic. Head over to registrymatters.co to find show notes and links and things of that nature. I often forget this, but also go head over to fypeducation.org. Leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. LarryCrackpot@gmail. I'm just kidding. RegistryMattersCast@gmail.com to email us, and I will distribute it around. And then please head over to patreon.com/registrymatters to support the program for as little as $1 a month, and it really helps us out. I hope everybody has a fabulous night and the rest of your weekend. Larry, I wish you a happy, warm weekend, and I will talk to you soon.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.